Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first,
Turkey's offensive against a Kurdish militia in Syria shows the growing expertise of Turkish arms manufacturers. In recent years, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has sought to reduce his country's dependency on imported arms. Erdogan spoke recently about the military operation in the Afrin area of northwestern Syria. Almost all of the armored carriers in Afrin are domestically produced. I thank our friends who produced them, he said. The Turkish military is working with Syrian rebels to seize Afrin from a Kurdish militia that Turkey calls a terrorist group. Turkish officials say its fighters are linked to Kurdish separatists in Turkey. Erdogan also blamed the deaths of Turkish soldiers in Afrin on countries that did not sell Turkey complex weapons, including armed drones. He did not name any countries. Last year, Erdogan took direct control of Turkey's arms industry. The government has invested billions of dollars in the defense industry. Further investments are planned. A total of 55 projects worth $9.4 billion were evaluated, said a presidential statement in January at a meeting of Turkey's Undersecretariat for Defense Industries. Attila Yeşilada watches Turkey for Global Source Partners, a business advisory service. He says the defense industry has grown in large part because of Turkey's Justice and Development Party, the AKP. Yeşilada said, in the past there was no money, but now there is a lot of money slushing around, and the AKP has the vision to realize this project. This is a success story of the AKP, he added. He said that Turkey once bought 80% of its weapons from overseas. Today, Turkey manufactures its own rifles, simple drones, and armored vehicles. Reducing dependency on imported arms is a goal of the government. I'm Katie Weaver.
Children of all ages gathered in New York City recently for the International Toy Fair. Hidden among already popular toys were new, high-tech educational products. Educational products are important to the toy industry. In recent years, parents have shown an interest in STEM-related toys, ones that help teach science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. But now, toy makers are working to create products for improving a child's emotional intelligence. These toys reportedly not only help raise intelligence in children, but also their emotional quotient, or EQ. Companies showed off their products last week at New York's Jacob Javits Convention Center. PlEIQ is a set of plastic toy blocks. It uses augmented reality technology to teach words, numbers, and other things. Edison Duran directs the company that makes PlEIQ. She showed people at the toy fair how virtual images appear on the blocks when they are held in front of a tablet camera. Intelligence includes intrapersonal skills, processing information within one's mind, and interpersonal skills, or dealing with other people. Duran said PlEIQ builds on both by having children act as teacher or guide to a companion character. On the other side of the convention center, Karen Hu demonstrated an educational robot called Wubu, who asked the hairy green robot, "Hi, what's your name?" With a childlike voice, the toy answered, "Are you trying to trick me? My name is Wubu." The robot comes programmed with educational games and activities. Children use its touchscreen face to get them started. Toys that work as companions also aid in social development. Hu described how the robot can help a child who has autism spectrum disorder.
He can communicate with Wubu, and he can follow some of the instruction Wubu is giving, because he thinks of this as a companion instead of, a parent or instead of someone else telling him to do certain things.
A more low-tech companion is a toy animal called Manimo. The manufacturer says this toy can help reduce hyperactivity in children and improve their ability to pay attention to a subject. Whether it's a snake, dolphin, or other animal, Manimos can be placed across a child's arm, chest, or neck. Karine Gagner, president of Manimo, explained that adding deep pressure to one's body can help calm a child before bedtime. At the EQtainment stand, sales director Jonathan Erickson explained the company's toys. "The purpose of all our products is to develop emotional and social intelligence," he said. I'm Susan Shand.
For VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. This week, we are going to show you how to give advice using modal verbs. Modal verbs, called modals for short, are auxiliary verbs that express a speaker's attitude and the strength of that attitude. For example,
he should visit Prague.
In this sentence, should is the modal verb, and visit is the main verb. The simple form of a verb goes after a modal. Do not add the third person S to a verb after a modal. It would sound strange to say,
he should visit Prague.
Or,
he should to visit Prague.
The correct way is,
he should visit Prague.
There are about 17 modals in English. Grammar experts do not agree on an exact number. Today, we will focus on three common modals used for giving advice: should, ought to, and had better.
Let's start with should. Should has multiple meanings. It can be used to express certainty, such as, "He should be here by 5 o'clock." Should can be a substitute for the conditional word if. You might hear someone say, "Should you need help, just ask me." But more often, we use should to give suggestions and friendly advice, such as,
"You should apply for that job."
Or,
"You should try that new restaurant."
The past form of the modal should is should have plus the past participle. For example,
"I should have brought my wallet."
Notice that the main verb brought is in the past participle form. Use should have to express regret or a negative feeling about the past. Imagine you trusted someone and that person later cheated on you. You could say,
"I should have known better than to trust him."
The Beatles used the expression in a popular song.
The next modal we will talk about is ought to. Ought to is another modal for giving advice. Sometimes ought to sounds more like oughta, as in this romantic song by Al Green. Is similar in meaning to should, but it is not used as often. In modern American English, ought to is seldom used with the past tense or in the question form. Let's move on to had better. Had better is stronger than should and ought to. Had better carries an indirect threat. For example, if you said,
"You had better finish that report,"
you are not making a polite suggestion. You are making an indirect threat. In other words, if you don't finish the report, you are in trouble. Authority figures sometimes use "had better" when speaking to people below them. Parents also use this form often. Listen to cartoon character Mallory Archer. Mallory is the head of a spy agency. People think she is arrogant and heartless. Listen to her tone when she uses had better.
"Oh, I'll send up some help. And Missy, you had better watch it."
As you can hear, Mallory is not making a polite suggestion. She is threatening someone in a lower position. Had better is not always impolite. It could express a sense of urgency, as in,
"Your plane is leaving. You had better run."
In other words,
"If you don't run, you will miss your flight."
Had better has no past tense or question form.
Should, ought to, and had better can be difficult for English learners to hear. Native speakers often shorten these words in casual conversation. In rapid speech, modals seem to disappear because they are shortened and often fall on unstressed syllables. We will read some examples for you. The first sentence will be in slow, careful speech. Then we will read it again in rapid, informal speech.
I should have been listening to what she had to say.
I should have been listening to what she had to say.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
You had better decide what you want to do.
You'd better decide what you want to do. That's all the advice we have for you today. There is much more to learn about modals. We will cover them in more detail in future episodes. Until then, you should practice modals with British punk band The Clash.
Darling, you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know.
I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Just before sunrise on April 12, 1861, the first shot was fired in the American Civil War. A heavy mortar roared, sending a shell high over the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina. The shell dropped and exploded above Fort Sumter, a United States military base on an island in the harbor. The explosion was a signal for all Confederate guns surrounding the fort to open fire. Shell after shell smashed into the fort. The booming of the cannons woke the people of Charleston. They rushed to the harbor and cheered as the bursting shells lighted the dark sky. Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer tell about the attack on Fort Sumter.
Confederate leaders ordered the attack after President Abraham Lincoln refused to withdraw the small force of American soldiers at Sumter. Food supplies at the fort were very low, and Southerners expected hunger would force the soldiers to leave. But Lincoln announced he was sending a ship to Fort Sumter with food. Confederate President Jefferson Davis ordered his commander in Charleston, General Beauregard, to destroy the fort before the food could arrive.
The attack started from Fort Johnson, across the harbor from Sumter. A Virginia congressman, Roger Pryor, was visiting Fort Johnson when the order to fire was given. The fort's commander asked Pryor if he would like the honor of firing the mortar that would begin the attack. No, answered Pryor, and his voice shook. I cannot fire the first gun of the war. But others could, and the attack began.
At Fort Sumter, Major Robert Anderson and his men waited 3 hours before firing back at the Confederate guns. Anderson could not use his most powerful cannons. They were in the open, at the top of the fort, where there was no protection for the gunners. Too many of his small force would be lost if he tried to fire these guns. So Anderson had his men fire the smaller cannon from better protected positions. These, however, did not do much damage to the Confederate guns.
The shelling continued all day. A big cloud of smoke rose high in the air over Fort Sumter. The smoke was seen by United States Navy ships a few miles outside Charleston Harbor. They had come with the ship bringing food for the men at Sumter. There were soldiers on these ships, but they could not reach the fort to help Major Anderson. Confederate boats blocked the entrance to the harbor, and Confederate guns could destroy any ship that tried to enter. The commander of the naval force, Captain Fox, had hoped to move the soldiers to Sumter in small boats, but the sea was so rough that the small boats could not be used. Fox could only watch and hope for calmer seas.
Confederate shells continued to smash into Sumter throughout the night and into the morning of the second day. The fires at Fort Sumter burned higher, and smoke filled the rooms where soldiers still tried to fire their cannons. About noon, three men arrived at the fort in a small boat. One of them was Lewis Wigfall, a former United States senator from Texas, now a Confederate officer. He asked to see Major Anderson. "I come from General Beauregard," he said. "It is time to put a stop to this, sir. The flames are raging all around you, and you have defended your flag bravely. Will you leave, sir?" Wigfall asked.
Major Anderson was ready to stop fighting. His men had done all that could be expected of them. They had fought well against a much stronger enemy. Anderson said he would surrender if he and his men could leave with honor. Wigfall agreed. He told Anderson to lower his flag and the firing would stop. Down came the United States flag, and up went the white flag of surrender. The battle of Fort Sumter was over. More than 4,000 shells had been fired during the 33 hours of fighting, but no one on either side was killed. One United States soldier, however, was killed the next day when a cannon exploded as Anderson's men prepared to leave the fort.
The news of Anderson's surrender reached Washington late Saturday, April 13th. President Lincoln and his cabinet met the next day and wrote a declaration that the president would announce on Monday. In it, Lincoln said powerful forces had seized control in 7 states of the South. He said these forces were too strong to be stopped by courts or policemen. Lincoln said troops were needed. He requested that the states send him 75,000 soldiers. He said these men would be used to get control of forts and other federal property seized from the Union.
Lincoln knew he had the support of his own party. He also wanted Northern Democrats to give him full support. So, Sunday evening, a Republican congressman visited the top Democrat of the North, Senator Stephen Douglas. The congressman urged Douglas to go to the White House and tell Lincoln that he would do all he could to help put down the rebellion in the South. At first, Douglas refused. He said Lincoln had removed Democrats, friends of his, from government jobs, and had given the jobs to Republicans. Douglas said he didn't like this. Anyway, he said, Lincoln probably did not want his advice. The congressman George Ashmun, urged Douglas to forget party politics. He said Lincoln and the country needed the senator's help. Douglas finally agreed to talk with Lincoln. He and Ashmun went immediately to the White House.
Lincoln welcomed his old political opponent. He explained his plans and read to Douglas the declaration he would announce the next day. Douglas said he agreed with every word of it, except, he said, 75,000 soldiers would not be enough. Remembering his problems with Southern extremists, he urged Lincoln to ask for 200,000 men. He told the president, "You do not know the dishonest purposes of those men as well as I do." Lincoln and Douglas talked for 2 hours. Then the senator gave a statement for the newspapers. He said he still opposed the administration on political questions, but, he said, he completely supported Lincoln's efforts to protect the Union. Douglas was to live for only a few more months. He spent this time working for the Union. He traveled through the states of the Northwest, making many speeches. Douglas urged Democrats everywhere to support the Republican government. He told them, "There can be no neutrals in this war, only patriots or traitors."
Throughout the North, thousands of men rushed to answer Lincoln's call for troops. Within 2 days, a military group from Boston left for Washington. Other groups formed quickly in northern cities and began training for war. Lincoln received a different answer, however, from the border states between North and South. Virginia's governor said he would not send troops to help the North get control of the South. North Carolina's governor said the request violated the Constitution. He would have no part of it. Tennessee said it would not send one man to help force Southern states back into the Union. But it said it would send 50,000 troops to defend Southern rights. Lincoln got the same answer from the governors of Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. For several days, it seemed that all these states would secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
Lincoln worried most about Virginia, the powerful state just across the Potomac River from Washington. A secession convention already was meeting at the state capital. On April 17th, the convention voted to take Virginia out of the Union. Virginia's vote to secede forced an American Army officer to make a most difficult decision. The officer was Colonel Robert E. Lee, a citizen of Virginia. The Army's top commander, General Winfield Scott, had called Lee to Washington. Scott believed Lee was the best officer in the Army. Lincoln agreed. He asked Lee to take General Scott's job to become the Army chief. Lee was offered the job on the same day that Virginia left the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.